There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
So, Dr. Heather Ead, naturopathic physician at Novamed Integrative Medicine. Hello and welcome back, Dr. Heather.
Hi, Suzanne. Great to be here. Thank you.
Good to see you. We are going to get into aging, genetics, how much of it's about genetics and the way that we age. I wonder, you've got a very nice complexion, Dr. Heather.
Thanks, Suzanne.
I'm just saying it. It's true. Do you take after your parents, do you think, in the way that you look?
I definitely take after my parents in the way that I look. I have to be honest with myself about that. facially after my dad and probably metabolically after my mother, yes.
So we think, look to the parents to get an indication of how our health is going to be as we age.
For sure.
When it comes to the wrinkles, when it comes to the skin maybe losing its elasticity, is it all down to genetics? We're going to be taking a look at an article that says and ask you why you may be aging faster than your friends or your peers. Let me know about your parents. Who do you take after when it's the aging, when the looks? My mum's got a lovely complexion. I'd like to think I do too.
Although, you sure do.
Well, you know what, actually, having said that, as I've got older, I've had probably more issues with skin than when I was younger. I wonder what that's all about. Maybe it's the hormones, maybe it's the environment. Is it going to affect how I age in the look of me? And this study is really interesting. We're going to get into it in a little while. They took a group of people in New Zealand at a certain age and monitored them throughout their lives. They're still living, but we've been spanning many years to see how they're aging. They're all the similar age, but how do they look and how are they internally as well as externally? Also, when it comes to anxiety and depression, you were saying to me, Dr. Heather, that for some reason you're getting more people coming to you for anxiety and depression. It seems to be on the rise, coming to you as a naturopath.
Yeah, recently I would say that's been the case, and I think people are looking to understand root cause of mood change rather than just being medicated for it. So there's lots of factors that play into how we regulate emotion. And I should say that, clinical depression just isn't about having trouble regulating emotion. So there is a difference between just general mood change and what qualifies as clinical depression or generalized anxiety. So we can talk a bit about that as well.
Excellent. So, send your questions through on 4001. And taking a look at this article, how many calories should I eat in a day? Now, this is a question that has been asked time and time again, understanding what calories really are. Now, this is coming out of the UK's Telegraph newspaper. Balancing calorie intake and usage lies at the crux of maintaining a healthy weight. Most of us know that if you eat as many calories as you burn, you'll maintain your weight, eat less and you'll lose weight, eat more and you'll gain weight. Sounds simple enough. In theory, yes, maybe. But in practice, maybe not so. As every individual uses and consumes a different number of calories at different rates, it can be difficult to get an accurate guideline that's tailored to your exact lifestyle. Now, this must be what you do a lot of in practice.
Yeah, I talk to people about this a lot and encourage them to get educated about what calories actually look like on the plate. It's a very interesting topic.
Well, tell us more then. So first off, what are calories?
Calories are a unit of energy expenditure, basically. So calories reflect how our bodies are burning fuel in the same way that you can measure fuel burning of any system in calories, basically. So when we burn calories, our bodies shrink. When we ingest calories, our bodies grow. And whether we're growing fat or muscle or connective tissue, to a certain degree depends on what we're eating. So what's in our macronutrients, which we'll talk a little bit about, but as well as what kind of demand and stress we're putting on our body. And what that really translates to is exercise, how we're moving and what kind of movement we're doing.
So even things like if you get, maybe you get that uncomfortable feeling after eating, like a sort of heartburn type sensation, that's actually putting stress onto the system.
Sure, absolutely. Sure. Even thinking puts stress on the system and burns calories. So we are constantly burning calories. And one of the things that I hear a lot in my practice is, oh, I'm really trying to lose weight. I have a slow metabolism, though. You know, I'm being sabotaged by my metabolism. And what your metabolism, what that word really means, metabolism or metabolic rate, is how many calories you're burning at rest. And that is easy to calculate by calculating muscle mass in clinic. It's our muscle mass that determines how many calories we're burning at rest. And most people are surprised by how many calories they are actually able to burn at rest. Now, what that speaks to is that most of us don't really know how many calories we're ingesting. So we may think that we're eating a healthy diet. This is a really common thing. By the time people come to see me, often they've already figured out, like, oh, I should be eating more greens and, you know, less fat or whatever. But most of us, even people that eat healthy foods, can overeat and consume too many calories and therefore not see the weight loss that they expect to see by eating quote unquote healthy.
Right? I think that's an important message, isn't it? So people think, well, I'm going gluten free. There's still calories.
Exactly. And in some instances, the gluten free options are a lot more processed than the gluten containing options. So higher in sugar, higher in refined carbohydrates, higher in calories.
What else is it that, you know, I've done a lot this year on veganism and following a plant-based lifestyle, which works for some people, not so well for others, whatever the reasons might be for going down that pathway. But again, it doesn't mean that people go, oh, it's healthier.
Right.
And it can be healthier for sure, eating a plant-based diet, but it doesn't mean that you're still consuming calories.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So and the strange thing too is that we don't really learn that in school, right? Like, I remember learning about the food pyramid, but I don't remember learning about what 200 calories looks like. And when it comes to practical knowledge about nutrition, especially in light of how many of our chronic diseases now are related to obesity and carrying extra weight, that kind of knowledge is much more practical than, you know, what are fruits and vegetables? What are whole grains? What is a lean protein? That's still important, but let's talk about what calorie intake actually looks like, right?
Well, when we come back, we'll be doing just that with Dr. Heather Ead. What does calorie intake look like? Also exploring what are empty calories, what are they for a healthy diet, and how many calories do you need? Many texting in already. Coming back for Stuart, said, sorry, I missed that comment about gluten-free. We're talking about calories and what they actually are, measures of energy and how many we should be using. And actually, when it comes to empty calories too, we're going to be looking at that. But, you know, when we think something's healthy, and it may not be as healthy as we think, including gluten-free products.
Right, because gluten-free products can be heavily processed and contain artificial ingredients or stabilizing agents, things that sort of take away from a food being a whole food versus a processed food. And sometimes, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, well, I lost weight on a gluten-free diet. Usually that happens because a gluten-free diet in general will probably reduce the amount of carbohydrate the person is eating, but it's easy to replace gluten-containing products with gluten-free products that are actually heavily processed, full of refined carbohydrates, and won't help a person lose weight. So the whole gluten-free idea is kind of trendy right now. When I talk to people, my patients, about gluten, it's more about the sort of digestive inflammation, celiac disease, food intolerance aspect, not specifically about weight loss.
So that really is probably the only reason why you should be excluding gluten if you've got an issue.
Yeah, I think so. Autoimmune conditions, there's lots of compelling research, new research about the relationship between gluten and turning on the genes that code for autoimmune conditions. So I'm now starting, I mean, when I first started practicing, we knew we had an idea about that in theory, but we didn't have the evidence behind it. So now that the clinical evidence is there, that is a recommendation I make for the people that I see with autoimmune conditions for sure. But in the context of weight loss, not necessarily.
And Anne messaged in to say, I lost some weight recently by serving my food on smaller plates. It really does make me eat smaller portions.
Yeah, great, great tip. And an interesting experiment in portion size, right? The fact that just reducing the size of the plate that we eat off of tricks our eyes into thinking that we're eating enough and therefore we eat less.
Do you think generally people overeat? We're eating too much, we're consuming too much.
Yeah, I do. I do. And when I talk to people about it, I mean, we're all human. I mean, I have days when I reflect on my own calorie, of course, on my own calorie consumption, right? It is really easy to overeat. And if we're relying on other people, like if we're relying on other people to plan meals for us, if we're eating out or we're ordering in or whatever, then that's it. We've lost the dominion over our own calorie intake, right? And because most of us aren't really educated about or don't really know what calories look like on the plate, it's easy to sort of trick ourselves into like, oh, well, I'm eating fish and I'm eating chicken and I'm eating brown rice and I'm eating broccoli. Well, those are all healthy foods. So therefore, I'm going to lose weight if I eat this way. And the truth is, it's a little bit more complicated than that. So this whole concept of knowing what your calories look like, understanding what your macros are, there's great tools to help us with that now. It used to be very difficult to figure that out. You'd spend hours and hours with a nutritionist. The nutritionist would take hours figuring out a meal plan for you that would get you the macros you need. Macros are basically how many carbs, how many grams of protein, how many grams of fat, etc. And reflect that to calorie intake. But now we have tools online that can help us with that. There's some great apps that can help us with that.
Yeah, we were looking here at the Telegraph article and they've listed some. MyFitnessPal, Lose It, Fat Secret. They're all apps that can help you monitor
absolutely
what the calories are, what the nutrients are. And I think that was the thing that I started to turn a corner when I started to look at what's my friend, the body needs nutrients to thrive.
Right.
So what are the foods that are nutrient rich for me?
Yeah, really great question as well. And that's where we get into this idea of, you know, what is a valuable calorie and what's an empty calorie? And that's especially important for people who, you know, for people who are getting on a weight loss kind of a program and they're becoming more active and trying to exercise more, then that aspect of nutrient density becomes even more important because they're going to be putting a different kind of stress on their body, right?
So when we're talking about empty calories, we're talking about things like, okay, I can see a chocolate bar and that's got so many calories. I can see maybe a bowl of fruit that's got so many calories. You're going to go for the one that's going to give you the nutrients.
Right. So that's a really good example, actually. So let's say you're really craving something sweet. You have the option of having 100 calories worth of chocolate or 100 calories worth of blueberries. Both have their merits, and there's certainly times when any of us will go for the chocolate for sure, right? And it's okay to do that if you understand your macros and understand your calorie intake. You're not going to hurt yourself by doing that, right? But of course, in the blueberries, you're going to get a lot more zinc, you're going to get a lot more iron. You're probably, although chocolate is a pretty good source of magnesium, you're going to get some magnesium in the blueberries as well. You're going to get more fiber in the blueberries, and those of course are all things that we need for cellular function. So if we're looking at our calorie intake at the end of the day, and let's say 20 or 25% of those calories have been not valuable calories, then we are going to become nutrient deficient. And then we're going to start developing signs and symptoms of nutrient deficiencies.
And is that common to you? Nutrient deficiency?
Of course, I see that all the time. I always, of course, ask people about food, and I try to get as much detail as possible from them about what their sort of daily food habits are. And that, along with a physical exam, actually gives me a lot of information about nutrient status. I do also sometimes test people, and when it's not clear to me, of course, I'll test people. And that's a whole other topic, how to test accurately for nutrient status, right? But people are sometimes surprised when they're eating a relatively healthy diet and they show up with various deficiency states. Of course, they want to know why and they want to know how to fix it.
So how many calories do I need? Now, everyone's different depending on your age.
The golden question.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's actually really hard to figure out, right? I mean, the only way to really figure that out accurately is to do very complex fitness testing to determine exactly how many calories you're burning based on your daily activity level and how many hours you're sedentary. We can get an idea of resting caloric needs, so how many calories you burn just sitting still from your muscle mass. And that's relatively easy to measure in clinic. And then when people really start seeing results with weight loss, often it coincides with building muscle, because the more muscle you're carrying, the easier it is for you to burn calories. And in a very general sense, that's why men tend to lose weight faster than women. They carry more muscle mass than women do. It's not because they're better at weight loss. They just have more muscle mass, right?
If you say so, Dr. Heather, I'm sure it's right. People are texting, and we're going to come back and address your messages here. We have somebody asking about thyroid, how to regulate the thyroid without supplements or medicine. Is that possible? Also, somebody's asking to please talk about intermittent fasting and whether that's good or not. And Jane's messaging to say, this is a useful discussion, and is BMI an accurate indicator of weight? That's a good question. We'll
Great
be addressing
question.
All of those when we come back. Send your questions through. Dr. Heather Ead is back with us today, naturopathic physician at Novamed Integrative Medicine, based in Sunset Mall on the Beach Road, here to take your questions on a wide range of health complaints, from weight management, allergies, fertility even, skin complaints, hormone imbalance. Many are messaging in. It's great to have you back in the chair, Dr. Heather, which actually is going to be our last show together.
I can't even start to talk about it. It's really makes me sore in my heart to think about it. It's been a long time, Suzanne.
It has, Heather. Yeah, it's not Heather that's leaving, it's me. I'm relocating. I'm leaving Dubai Eye. But we go right back to before Dubai today, when I had Eye on Health on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And you just arrived into the UAE. You'd only been in here a few months. We're going back about 8 years ago now, 2009.
Right. Yeah, I remember speeding to that first interview, getting all kinds of speeding fines, but making it.
And making up for it, of course. So I'd be here on my own in the Dubai Eye building on the weekends. And then you arrived and you came in, and that was the beginning of what has been an amazing journey with you, Dr. Heather.
Yeah, well, you've been a huge part of my professional life here in Dubai. It's been really, really amazing to be able to come on a regular basis. And, you know, we see the questions each time, and they, you know, we see these repeating themes in questions people are asking about their health. And it's just, it's amazing to think back on, you know, all of those people, all of those questions over the years.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, when I was reflecting, as I am doing over the, you know, I've got five more shows left on Dubai today, and looking at the people like you that have really been there from the beginning with me. And I think about some of the, I think before that, there hadn't really been a lot in the UAE. There'd been some, but when it came to complementary medicine and understanding the power of that and the value of that, and that you have options, and you have been a forerunner of that here in the UAE, really taking that forward, I think, with the qualifications you bring to us here in the UAE from Canada, and how I know how, I mean, I know you've got a long waiting list, so there you go. I mean, many patients responded.
The fact that there is a demand for it, you know, I when I first came here, it was really clear right from the beginning that you know, my wait list is a function of how many people have these questions, and how many people are looking for a functional approach, not just a sort of, you know, 5-minute doctor visit. They want to really understand what's going on with their bodies, and they want to understand how to solve potentially chronic problems as naturally and preventatively as possible. Mm. And the fact that, you know, people like me have been really busy consistently, to me means that there's a real thirst in this region for it. And I think what's going on in this region reflects what's going on all over the world as well.
Well, that's right. Exactly that. And I think for me, one of the things for over the last 9 years of being back in the UAE and with the show in the last 6 years has been about bringing the stories that are relevant to people of the UAE. And as the UAE has grown, I think the UAE has always been about, you know, there's always been a connection to health and wellness here.
Sure.
People like to talk across the cultures. They want to know more. They want to understand. They want to talk about it. But because of certain lifestyle pressures and adaptability, it can be hard to fulfill all of those measures, really, to have a thriving life. But the conversation continues.
Right.
So it's been fantastic having you as part of that conversation.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure and honor for me, Suzanne.
Well, thank thank you. And the conversation will continue on Dubai Today and Ion Health, but I am going to be basing myself in Portugal. I'm sure I'll be back in and out of Dubai because I've been coming here for the last 20 years or so. And yeah, so I'm going to be probably actually taking a leaf out of the book of what I practice or preach. I'm going to be practicing. So I'm going to be living in the mountains of the Algarve. I'm going to be breathing in that fresh air, taking a bit of time out for me and a bit of development. I'm going to be doing a coaching course, so I will be qualified as a coach next year. And yeah, and dipping in and out of the UAE, writing, etc. So, you know,
don't worry, we'll find you.
Oh, and it'll continue, and everybody's here continuing with Dubai Today, so it's not going to change, and it's going to be wonderful. The Dubai Today family will continue on. So getting back into discussion today and looking at so many messages coming in, we've been talking about calories, what they are, how to understand them better, how do they look on our plate. Jane raised a really good point here. She's saying, is BMI an accurate indicator of weight? My husband is 6'4" and if his weight was within the BMI recommendation, he would be stick thin. So BMI, what is it?
Great question. So BMI stands for body mass index, and it's basically a measurement of height and weight. It really tells us nothing about body fat percentage, about muscle mass, about fluid mass. And for a long time, BMI was what doctors would rely on in order to understand if a person is clinically obese or overweight or not. But there's a lot of flaws with BMI, mainly that they count a kilo as a BMI counts a kilo as a kilo and doesn't tell us if that's a kilo of fat, a kilo of muscle. So someone who's very tall and relatively muscular will have a BMI that might put them in the overweight or obese category. And they, if we actually measure their body fat percentage, they're not obese at all. So more and more doctors and clinics are moving away from BMI and moving towards body fat percentage. The newer research, clinical trials that are being done on weight loss and that sort of thing are using body fat percentage. They're not using BMI anymore. Certainly at Novamed, we only use body fat percentage. I mean, it's easy to calculate BMI, and people often ask me, what's my BMI? And then I have to steer them away from that number and explain the value of measuring body fat percentage, muscle mass.
And here, asking about intermittent fasting.
Yeah, great question as well. Intermittent fasting is a bit of a trend right now in the sort of dieting weight loss realm. Basically, what it means is limiting your calorie intake to certain times during the day. So either starting later in the day or, you know, making sure all of your calorie intake happens only over the course of 8 hours or something during the day. And the reason it seems to work with weight loss is basically through calorie restriction. That when people are taking longer to start eating during the day, they will naturally consume fewer calories. Or if they're forcing themselves to eat only between, you know, 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., they will naturally consume fewer calories. So I don't necessarily put people on an intermittent fasting program, but if that seems to work for them, the great thing about intermittent fasting is that it can allow you to cheat a little bit. So if you're being really careful with intermittent fasting throughout the week, you can have a bit of a blowout on the weekend without really derailing your calorie intake throughout the week. Whereas if you're not doing the intermittent fasting, it's easier to kind of go wrong with that. So if it works for people, I encourage it, but it's not right for everybody.
And this comment here, I'm not sure that I understand the benefits of the different dietary products you can buy. You know, you're talking about gluten-free, and then there's low-carb, sugar-free, you name it. There's a conflict of interest. You can't trust anyone who sells stuff, according to our listener messaging here. So interested in passing on more stuff to you to help you reduce your weight. So when you're interested in getting less stuff into you, you can only do it by yourself.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And this is why I think education around diet and calorie intake is so important. I mean, the person that is deciding what goes on the food label is not interested in actually educating you about what's in that food. They're interested in selling that food, right? So when something says low carb, then that might mean that it's fairly high fat and therefore high calorie. When something says it's sugar free, that probably means that it's artificially sweetened. When something says it's low fat, it by default is probably relatively high in carbohydrates. So getting educated about how to read a food label, getting educated about what your macronutrients are and how much of them you should be getting, and using that information to assess what's on a food label, that is really useful, practical information.
So the British Dietary Association recommends a deficit of 500 calories a day alongside gradually increasing physical activity in order to lose weight in a safe and sustainable way. This should result in a weight loss rate of 0.5 kilos to 1 kilos each week. The National Health System weight loss plan is based on a slightly higher deficit of 600 calories. And on this 12-week plan, men could or would consume no more than 1,900 calories and women no more than 1,400 calories. What do you think about these recommendations?
I think those are great baseline recommendations. The first critical thing to understand with that is how many calories am I getting in a day? So if they're telling me I need a deficit of 500 or 600 calories a day, I need to know how much I'm starting with, right? So one thing that I try and get people doing, first of all, we haven't talked yet about metabolic barriers with weight loss. I try to figure that out first. But if we're talking about just mathematics of calorie intake, I try to get people understanding how much they're actually getting. And that's where the apps are useful. You can use something like MyFitnessPal to not to try and lose weight, but just to track what your normal daily intake is like. And then we can compare that to what the BMR is, and then figure out how many calories they need to create as a deficit in order to see the weight loss that they want to see.
So when you're talking about metabolic barriers, things like insulin resistance, thyroid function, estrogen dominance, adrenal functions could all be things that no matter what you do, you're not going to lose that excess weight.
Right, exactly. So we can calculate your BMR, but if with your thyroid function, for example, you're not converting T4 into T3, then you're not going to be able to access that BMR. And I see a lot of people who actually are very educated about calorie intake, they're active on a regular basis, they're doing everything they can to eat healthy and still not losing weight. And that's when we do those assessments for thyroid function, for adrenal hormones, estrogen levels, cortisol levels, insulin, fasting, glucose, all of that stuff. And once we've got that collective information about metabolic regulation, that helps us understand the calorie aspect and the food intake aspect a lot more accurately.
Keep your questions coming in, lots coming in, not just on weight loss and calories, but on other issues as well. And this one from Augustine. Hello, nice talk on calories. Just ask to know, I'm addicted to ice cream. What's my chance of an increase in weight?
Your chances of an increase in weight are quite high, unfortunately.
We'll address all your questions when we come back. Dr. Heather E., naturopathic physician at NovaMed, and he goes on to ask, and we have pretty much every week this question's asked, and it's good to continue to talk about it. Belly fat, it's my problem. I tend to gain it easily, however it stays and resists. Any general recommendation to get rid of that belly fat?
Yeah, great question. So what we know about abdominal weight gain is that it tends to be related to cortisol production, stress. Cortisol is our stress hormone. So when people are already sort of healthy diet, exercising regularly, and they have this really stubborn abdominal weight gain issue, I tend to measure their cortisol levels. And in men, I will measure testosterone along with that, because testosterone and cortisol are both come from a common hormonal precursor, which is DHEA. And if the men's DHEA is being used up to produce a lot of cortisol, he'll get abdominal weight gain. And on top of that, his testosterone levels will drop, which will lower his muscle mass and therefore lower his metabolic rate. So he'll be doing the same thing with diet and exercise and just gaining belly fat over time if we can't lower the cortisol and bring up his testosterone levels.
Keep your messages coming in on diet and calories. And just to address a few other messages as well, this one here regarding the thyroid, and is it possible to regulate the thyroid without using supplements or medication?
Yeah, great question. And I do a lot of work with thyroid conditions, and there's a lot that we can do from that's natural and that's treating root cause, that's supporting T4 production, T4 to T3 conversion, rather than just the standard approach, which is sort of hormone replacement for T4. lifestyle factors that contribute to thyroid function. We just talked about cortisol. Cortisol regulation is really, really important. If your cortisol levels are high, that will impair T4 to T3 production. So that's stress. And when I'm talking about stress management, what I'm really talking about, what cortisol is very sensitive to, is just routine. So our cortisol production likes to see that we're eating our meals at roughly the same time every day, that we're exercising at roughly the same time every day, that we're getting enough sleep every night. So those aspects for regulating thyroid function are really important. Just exercise in general is very supportive of thyroid function. When you ask your body to burn calories with exercise, you're actually turning on your thyroid in order to do that. So when we're talking about preventing thyroid decline, or someone who's just been diagnosed with a thyroid condition, getting those elements in place is really important.
And then this message. Now, there's a there's a lot to this message. Let's start it, Dr. Heather, as we're running up to the news, and we're going to break this message down. Thank you very much for sending it in, Charlotte. It's here saying that I've been recently diagnosed with
psoriatic arthritis,
PSA, which causes swollen ankles. I've had this for the last 7 months. It's now moved onto my feet, causing plantar fasciitis.
Plantar fasciitis,
thank you very much. Originally, it was diagnosed as cellulitis and then gout. I've had mild psoriasis for many years and was also diagnosed with hypertension early this year. Let's start with that.
Yeah, so very interesting history in that she presented with swelling in the joints and joint pain, with a history of psoriasis, which is a skin condition. It's an autoimmune skin condition that causes sort of plaque formation on the skin, flaking skin, that sort of thing. So it's, what's interesting to me is that she had a history with psoriasis, and yet when she presented with joint pain, they thought it was gout, they thought it was cellulitis, which is an infection in the skin over the joint, rather than linking it to her history with psoriasis. The interesting thing about psoriasis being a skin condition is that it can also present as inflammation in the joints. So some people with the skin problem end up getting this autoimmune reaction in their joints later in life. And the fact that it is an autoimmune condition and not just an inflammatory condition makes treatment different, makes it different than treating regular arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis or osteoarthritis.
And she's been taking, she's been taking different anti-inflammatories, steroids for her ankles.
And the medicine that she's mentioning here is an immune suppressant. It's something that they give in autoimmune conditions. So she's been on three different types of medicines, the anti-inflammatories, the steroids, and this immune modulator, this immune suppressant.
So what would you advise at this stage then?
Yeah, so really great question. I see a lot of people with autoimmune conditions, and the conventional approach with autoimmune problems, and it's a good approach because it can interrupt really acute symptoms, is immune suppression and inflammation management. And usually to do that, they'll give high doses of steroids, which will bring down the inflammation typically, but certainly is not addressing root cause. And one of the tricky things with autoimmune conditions is that one of the things that can aggravate or bring on an autoimmune condition is a change in cortisol production. And when we give steroids, that massively changes how the body produces cortisol. So people will end up on steroids to bring down the inflammation and then have a rebound of their symptoms, sometimes even worse than the original symptoms when they come off the steroids. So autoimmune conditions in general respond really well to an integrative approach where we look at root cause, we look at what might have triggered the autoimmune response in the first place. We look at natural options at inflammation management that don't have the side effects that the steroids do. And if we're able to actually retrain the immune system, which is possible to do, we get that person into remission without needing medication. And I mean, I have to say it's one of my favorite areas of treatment because these people, it's not that the medicines aren't useful, they're really useful, but they suffer a lot on the medication and they're hard medicines to come off of.
Okay, so we're going to address more of this message when we come back. This lady's also talking about tiredness. It's the worst thing. Struggling with daily life and work and with a loss of concentration. You're not alone. When we hear those symptoms, it's quite common for people.
For sure.
So we'll address that and more when we come back, and also addressing more of your questions. Keep them coming in. We're also going to be asking or addressing or exploring, if you like, why you may be aging faster than your friends. Stay with us.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.
Dr. Heather Ead, naturopathic physician at Novamed Integrative Medicine, based in Sunset Mall, that lovely mall there. You've got a great view.
A lovely
view. From your office.
Best view in Dubai,
I think.
It
really is. Yeah. I don't know how you get any work done, really. You must just be sitting looking out the window at the beach and the sea.
It's just very zen.
And of course, here for the next hour to help you. It's our last show together, as I'll be moving on from Dubai Eye next week. So I'm counting down. Sadly, I'm very sad to be going, but also looking forward to a new chapter in my life as I explore new avenues of creativity. And as I said earlier, kind of practicing what I preach really on the show for the last 6 years, which is getting the balance in your life. So thanks for everyone for your messages. And yeah, thank you. There'll be more to come over the next few days as to what's happening there. But let's look at these messages, Heather. Now, one of our listeners has made a good point about the 100, 200, 500 calories. We're talking earlier about weight loss and calories. Actually, we'll come back to that. What does it actually look like? You mentioned that before. I want to find out. And we're also looking through a message as well from a lady that had a lot of issues going on with arthritis and possibly having the wrong diagnosis on some of her conditions. She also talked about this feeling of tiredness, the worst thing. I struggle with daily life and work with a loss of concentration. I also don't feel rested after 8 or 9 hours sleep, after only ever sleeping for 6 or 6.5 hours. Is this linked to the PSA or the drugs or both?
Yeah, great question. And to really answer that question, we'd probably have to do a couple of investigations with her. But it is really common after a dose of steroids to experience this fallout where there's generalized fatigue, there's poor sleep quality or never rested from sleep, there's poor concentration, poor focus. And that relates to how the medication suppresses your own cortisol production. So when you come off steroids, part of the reason they wean you off steroids is because your body has to relearn how to produce cortisol again, because the steroids massively suppress your own cortisol production. And when your cortisol falls very, very low, that tends to lead to symptoms like fatigue, poor sleep quality, poor concentration, that sort of thing. And it can really be a quality of life issue for people who are struggling with that. So with people who have been on steroids, no matter what reason they were on steroids, I'm often doing a little bit of work with them around restoring normal cortisol production. The other thing she mentioned that could be linked to the fatigue is that she was vitamin D deficient, and vitamin D status actually is absolutely critical in regulating autoimmune conditions. There's been lots of interesting literature research around where vitamin D levels should be in order to protect us against autoimmune conditions. And the normal reference range that we currently use for vitamin D is a reference range that really only reflects the role of vitamin D in bone density. We haven't changed the reference range yet to reflect what we need for protection against autoimmune conditions. So in patients that I see with autoimmune conditions, I try to get their vitamin D actually much higher than what the current normal reference range is. So often people come into me and say, oh, I had my vitamin D checked, it was normal, and then I asked them what it actually was, or I asked them to see the result, and maybe it was technically within that normal range, but still functionally low. So in her case, treating the vitamin D deficiency would be really important. But there's a lot of work that I do with diet around autoimmune conditions, with omega-3 fat intake and autoimmune status that this person would benefit from for sure.
Coming back then to the calories and what they look like. This person's saying, I know an apple is 100 kcal, so 20 mins in the cross trainer equals 2.5 apples, but that's as far as I go.
Yeah, so, and this is where we can make ourselves crazy with counting calories, right? When you're on the cross trainer busting your butt, the last thing you want to think about is that you've only burned off 1.5 apples by the time you've finished your workout, right?
Yeah.
So there's far
more. That's going to make you reach for the big cream cake, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's many more benefits to exercise than just how many calories you're burning. But in this context, that what's helpful about that is understanding what it means when we get into that mindset where it's like, oh, I had a good workout this morning, so I'm going to let myself cheat tonight. Or, you know, I've been exercising every day this week, so yeah, I'm going to go out and have a big blowout this weekend. I've earned it. And that mindset, it's not that the mindset is incorrect. It's just that if we allow ourselves too much sort of margin for error, then we don't see weight loss. And then people get really frustrated. They come into me and they say, you know, I'm careful with diet. I exercise 5 days a week. I'm pretty good with diet, except on weekends. What am I doing wrong? And if we actually look at calorie intake versus expenditure, they're undoing it with their little tiny cheats here and there.
What about sweet potato? This is the new debate, isn't it? That, you know, everyone like switch to sweet potatoes because they're better for us than white potato. So, you know, if you're having sweet potato fries, etc. And now people are saying that sweet potatoes are higher in calories than white potato.
Well, sweet potatoes, gram per gram. I mean, again, it depends on what white potato strain we're measuring. But gram per gram are higher in calories. But they're higher in fiber and higher in minerals, which delays, it makes the glucose from the sweet potato enter our bloodstream slower and therefore gives us more opportunity to burn off that glucose. But if you're overeating sweet potato on a regular basis, it's still going to result in weight gain.
And if you're frying them.
And if you're frying them.
I just love the way that people will trick. We all do it. We'll trick our minds into allowing us to eat things. And the gentleman earlier saying about the ice cream.
Right, you know. Right. And I mean, I get questions like this, like, Dr. Heather, what do you think of sweet potato fries? And it's like, well, I don't particularly have an opinion on sweet potato fries. It's just how they're factoring, how frequently they're factoring into a person's diet. That's the more important question, right? So in a general sense, we can say sweet potatoes are probably a better option than white potato. But yeah, if you're frying them, you're frying them. And that's not, you know, you can only get away with that so much, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. No. So what else have we got then to give us an idea of what calories look like?
Yeah, so this is a great, we're looking at a couple of photos here that, I mean, there's a couple of resources online that will show you, you know, what 100 calories of chicken breast looks like next to 100 calories of chocolate, for example. Those are great little visual tools. The one that I'm looking at that I think is quite compelling is there's a picture of a rice cake with almond butter or peanut butter on it that shows showing only 4 grams of protein, and we think of almond butter being, or peanut butter being, as a great source of protein, and next to it is basically 2 boiled eggs, which has 12 grams of protein. So we might think of like almond butter on a rice cracker as being a lighter snack than 2 boiled eggs, but we're going to get more protein density out of the 2 boiled eggs and therefore more opportunity to build muscle mass, recover from a workout, that sort of thing.
So that's the kind of thing you need to be researching and understanding.
Well, and the important, sorry, I should clarify that the important thing about this comparison is that gram per gram, we're talking about approximately the same volume of food. We're talking about, you know, roughly 100 grams of food, what you're getting in that 100 grams, the 12 grams of protein versus 4 grams of protein.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, understanding that you need to have some protein, some fiber,
right?
Some carbohydrates.
Right. So what people often ask me about, like, well, how many grams of protein should I get? How many grams of fat should I get? And you can actually calculate that based on knowing what your resting metabolic rate is, so how many calories you're burning at rest, and knowing that 1 gram of carbohydrate is about 4 calories and 1 gram of fat is about 9 calories. So if we know how many calories you need to be eating in a day or how much you want to be eating in order to lose weight, and then we calculate how many grams of protein, how many grams of fat, we can base that on a ratio that will accelerate fat loss. The ratio I usually try and start people at is about 30% carbohydrate, 30% fat, and 40% protein. Then you can use the apps to actually look at how many grams of protein is in 100 grams of chicken. So when you've got like 100 grams of chicken breast in front of you, that's actually about 25 or 30 grams of protein. It's not 100 grams of protein. So what I try to get people doing is for like 7 to 10 days or so, actually weighing out their food. It sounds like a real hassle to do, but it's not. You just get a little scale, stick it on your kitchen counter, and for a week or so, get an idea of how many grams are in the chicken that you're eating, are in the eggs that you're eating, are in the broccoli that you're eating. And then you can use the tools, the apps, to actually break down what that means in terms of grams of protein, grams of fat. And then you can use the apps as well to set your macros to that ratio, and it will tell you how close you're getting every day. And if you're doing that along with tracking the calories, then usually there is weight loss that goes with that. It's just making it a little bit more scientific than we like to make it. We want it to be easy. And in truth, it takes a period of education, of educating ourselves before it becomes easy.
Dr. Heather, lots of messages have come in actually, coincidentally, around supplementation, but really to do with calcium. A couple of messages here. One here from Layla: my 13-year-old son doesn't drink milk or eat cheese or have calcium through dairy. Would you recommend a calcium and magnesium supplement for him? He eats a lot of broccoli and loves lentils and pulses.
You know, this is my favorite question, Susan.
We've made a happy doctor today.
Yeah, let's talk about calcium and dairy. This is probably one of the biggest myths in nutrition, that we need to eat dairy in order to get calcium. Dairy, gram per gram, dairy products gram per gram are very high in calcium, but they're also very high in phosphorus, which in the human digestive tract, we can't cleave the phosphorus from the calcium. So the calcium and the phosphorus staying bound together in our digestive tract actually makes the calcium not available to us for absorption. And this isn't my theory. This is very clear in the literature around calcium consumption from dairy, that the studies that have looked at dairy consumption in humans long term actually show higher rates of osteoporosis, osteopenia, fracture in people who consume a lot of dairy products. So the idea that we need calcium for bone density and that we can get good bone protection from dairy consumption is a myth. It's a myth that's been propagated by the food industry. I'm not afraid to say that, because it really is something that I find, you know, it as a clinician, I find it frustrating when there are pervasive myths about nutrition that actually mislead us. It's one thing if it's neutral and not harmful to us to believe in that myth, but when it can potentially actually be harmful to us, it's frustrating to me, right? So human digestive tract is good at absorbing dairy from things like leafy green vegetables, from pulses, from fish, from nuts and seeds, and it is actually relatively easy to get calcium from food. We've sort of been led to believe that we all need to supplement with calcium. There's been this emphasis on bone density over time, which is very important, but I very rarely see calcium deficiency in my practice, even in people who never eat dairy. I myself am very low with dairy intake and have never been calcium deficient. If anything, where I've seen calcium deficiency, it's related to people being low in vitamin D. And then when we correct the vitamin D, calcium levels correct themselves. So if this person is eating a lot of fish, a lot of beans and pulses, a lot of green vegetables, they are not going to become calcium deficient, even if they're not supplementing, and certainly not because they're not having dairy in their diet. Cows and other ruminants are really good at cleaving phosphorus from calcium. They have that ruminant stomach that does that for them. So cows are really good at absorbing calcium from cow's milk. Great for baby cows. Human breast milk, really high in calcium, but low in phosphorus because we can't cleave it, right? So if we're going to be drinking milk, we should actually be having milk from another primate and not from a ruminant animal like a cow. But that's a whole other topic of discussion. When are we just going to start seeing gorilla milk in the supermarket? And that makes people feel weird, right? They don't want to think about drinking baboon milk or gorilla milk. But biologically, that would be more valuable to us. And the fact that we don't think it's weird to drink milk from a ruminant animal, to me, is very unusual, right?
That's why I've loved doing this show with you over the last 8 years, Dr. Heather.
These are the things I think about in my spare time.
There's always something in there in that 2-hour show that makes me go, I didn't know that. And I've got to go away and think about that now. And maybe even do a bit of my own research, homework. Fantastic. Well, what do you think about that? Let us know on 4001. When we're talking about calcium, we should also talk about magnesium. We could talk about magnesium anyway in its own right. Looking here at this headline, magnesium deficiency raises your risk of many chronic ailments and possibly even premature death. What do you make of that, Dr. Heather?
Yeah, this is a really good topic, and it's a great segue from the calcium topic, because the other reason that the other reason that I follow the literature around calcium and calcification is that there are risks to over-consuming calcium. And the main risk is calcification in the arteries, which of course is the root cause of that, and inflammation, chronic inflammation, are the root causes of cardiovascular disease. We don't get cardiovascular disease from high cholesterol. We get cardiovascular disease from calcification, calcium depositing in blood vessel linings, and inflammation, which then kind of sucks in the cholesterol. So when people are over-supplementing with calcium, that can potentially accelerate calcification and therefore accelerate things like cardiovascular disease. Now, what stops calcification from happening or prevents calcium deposition in blood vessel linings, in part, is magnesium. And if our magnesium status is low, then that will drive calcification as well. So what is much more common than too little calcium is too little magnesium. Our needs for magnesium are a little bit higher than calcium, and our the actual availability of magnesium in food is somewhat lower than calcium.
So we need magnesium. Well, okay, we lose magnesium through sweating.
Yeah,
maybe if you're insulin resistant, or even through certain drugs.
Yeah, we lose magnesium through diuretics, whether we're taking medicine, like for medicine for blood pressure, for example, will make us lose magnesium. We also lose magnesium from diuretics in our diet, like coffee, alcohol, that sort of thing. Caffeine is a bit of a diuretic. We lose magnesium through stress. The pathways that produce stress hormones burn through magnesium like crazy. We lose magnesium when we go through hormonal changes, because those pathways are also reliant on magnesium. So when a person presents with symptoms of magnesium deficiency, muscle pain, muscle cramping, twitching, maybe their blood pressure is going up a little bit, they can't sleep properly, they're tired, they can't concentrate, sometimes I'll test for magnesium status. But if they have any of those factors in their diet, lifestyle, that are leaching out magnesium, then that makes getting more in their diet important, and potentially supplementation important.
We were talking about magnesium just before, and Faraz is asking how to increase magnesium intake. So how to test for magnesium deficiency?
Yeah. Great.
As well.
So great question. And we'll talk about some of the foods that are high in magnesium. But one of the things to keep in mind, if you are concerned about magnesium levels and you're asking your doctor about testing for magnesium, only about 1% of the body's magnesium is actually in the serum. The rest is in our tissues or inside our cells. So if we're going to do a blood test for magnesium, it has to be red cell magnesium. It has to be intracellular magnesium. And most standard lab tests just look at serum magnesium. So your serum magnesium may appear in normal range, but because there's so little magnesium normally in the serum, you can still actually be deficient within the cell. So if you're getting it measured, ask for red cell magnesium, not serum magnesium. In terms of how to increase your intake, the food sources that are really good, again, are leafy green vegetables, great source of minerals in general. Nuts and seeds, especially almonds and pumpkin seeds, really high in magnesium. Avocado, beans and pulses, especially black beans, really high in magnesium. Figs are high in magnesium, bananas, even dark chocolate, really good source of magnesium. So sometimes people that are craving dark chocolate a lot, it's actually the magnesium that their body's looking for.
This question came in from Anne. I've had Crohn's disease for about 30 years with flare-ups about every 4 years in the early days when I was successfully treated with steroids. The flare-ups become more frequent the older I get. And since 2012, I was put on Humira for 4 years. And I'm now on Imuran permanently. However, the meds are keeping me pain-free, although the inflammation is still present. I'm also taking vitamin B, C, D and calcium and turmeric. Would love to come off the meds and cure my Crohn's by diet. What do you think? Is that possible?
It is totally possible. And I routinely see patients with inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's and get them into remission. The key about the one sort of question mark for me is that if the medicine was doing its job, then there would not be inflammation anymore. So the fact that she is still getting inflammation, and I'm assuming what she means is that when they test her stool, they're still seeing elevated levels of fecal calprotectin, which is a marker for inflammation in the stool. That's something we track regularly in Crohn's disease. If that fecal calprotectin is still elevated, the medicine is not controlling the inflammation, and the risk factors of having Crohn's disease are still there. Crohn's disease increases the risk of colon cancer because the cells are constantly having to heal from the inflammation, and that increases the chance of mutation. So even though it's keeping her pain at bay, she's actually not in remission with the medicine. So really good candidate for treatment that approaches the root cause of Crohn's, which is also an autoimmune condition. So we work on regulating the immune system through diet. There's certain supplements that are useful. Gut flora regulation is really important in any inflammatory bowel condition. Vitamin D status, really important. I would be very hesitant to supplement with calcium in someone with chronic inflammation because that can increase the risk of other calcification. But she's on the right track with the turmeric. I think it would just mean sort of tweaking her supplement regimen and getting her on board with the right dietary approach. And with diet in autoimmune conditions, it's all about regulating the immune response through lowering IgG4 levels. IgG4 is a type of antibody, and if you're producing elevated levels of IgG4 to certain food antigens, those are the foods that need to come out of the diet. And that's, we can test for that.
Mm. Just quickly, the difference between irritable bowel syndrome and Crohn's.
Right. So Crohn's is an inflammatory condition. Irritable bowel syndrome is not. Crohn's is an autoimmune condition. Irritable bowel syndrome is not. Crohn's disease predisposes to other risks like colon cancer. Irritable bowel syndrome does not. But the symptoms can be very similar.
Okay. So let's take a look at this aging. Are you aging faster than your friends? We're looking at this article from Time magazine. I'll give you it in a nutshell, pretty much, that they took a group of people, researchers, looking at the aging, a panel of 80 measures tested in 20 and 30 year olds that showed how quickly they were aging. The markers proved to be a good indicator of physiological age. They mirrored the biological effects of aging found in older people, but there were also good markers of physical age, meaning that those who aged faster also looked older, according to unbiased assessments by random people looking at their photographs. So most studies on aging and the factors that affect aging come from investigations of older populations. And in most cases, the chronic diseases or physiological changes that come with aging are already well established in these groups. But it's clear that aging doesn't happen overnight. Rather, it occurs gradually over a period of decades. And so we're aware of that. But how are we affected? So in this study, 954 people born in 1972 or 73 in Dunedin, New Zealand, agreed to participate in the study that followed them from age 26 to age 38. Each participant agreed to be tested on a range of 18 different factors that earlier studies have linked to aging, so including blood pressure, lung function, cholesterol, body mass index, inflammation, and the integrity of their DNA. Based on their scores on these measures, researchers calculated a biological age for each volunteer. They did this again when the people in the study were 32 and 38 years old and combined them to calculate the pace at which each person was aging. What came out of this was that, yes, genetics are linked. There are links to how your parents or grandparents are to your aging process. But actually, it also came up that we can control it and we can change it as well. What did you make of it, Dr.
Yeah,
Heather?
It's an interesting article, and it speaks to the assumption we had when we went through this whole trend in medicine where they were doing the human genome mapping and everybody got excited about genomics and genetics in understanding disease risk and preventative medicine. And there's still a lot that we can learn from genetics that's really important and relevant. And I mean, I certainly use a little bit of genetic testing in my practice, for sure. What was interesting about this article was that the actual, when it relates to aging and what, how we age and how quickly our tissues decline and how that relates to death rates and that sort of thing, we thought when we started understanding genetics that there would be, that the genetic component to aging would be much more prominent than it actually is. So it was really interesting from this study, even though the article doesn't go into detail about what parameters they're measuring, we can talk about that a little bit because there's certainly parameters that I monitor in my patients that relate to aging. What was raised was that only about 20% of that process is related to genetics, and that 20% is actually kind of malnourished. malleable. Mm. We can, even if we have genetics that predispose to certain age-related conditions, we can actually control whether or not, through environmental factors, dietary factors, etc., control whether or not those genes are actually going to be expressed. And that's very exciting. Mm, that's very compelling.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you can make a difference.
Absolutely.
This study is going to continue. They're going to be tested again and looked at again when they're 45 years of age. So it's quite fascinating. It does go on to throw in a load of ingredients that obviously we're not saying, well, for example, on bananas comes up, why they're good for you. But we're not suggesting just by eating bananas, you're going to slow down the aging process. If only.
If only.
Yeah, yeah. But they are good for us if you can eat bananas. There's a lot in there for when it comes to fiber, when it comes to a little bit of protein, actually, which I wouldn't have thought of, I suppose. What do you recommend when it comes to bananas?
Well, bananas, I mean, I say this to my patients. I see a lot of patients with insulin resistance and a lot of patients that are trying to lose weight. And, you know, it's not my phrase. I heard it somewhere else. But bananas are sort of like the Twinkie of the fruit world. It's like the cupcake of the fruit world, right? So delicious. Most people love bananas, but they're really high in sugar. So the benefits of having bananas are, of course, like the fiber, the potassium. They're really high in potassium. They are high in magnesium. But we can get those minerals from other foods, certainly. So I don't, you know, whether or not I encourage people to eat bananas or not is really dependent on what else is going on for them health-wise. And if they are, you know, we know that weight and body fat percentage is really closely tied to age-related conditions. So if they're trying to regulate their weight, then bananas are kind of off the table, you know.
So what is on the table if you've got insulin resistance or if you can't shift that belly fat, but you still want people to eat fruit, or should they not be eating fruit?
Yeah, great question as well. So I do limit people's fruit intake, and I try to get them sticking to sort of the high antioxidant, low glycemic index fruits like cherries, berries, that sort of thing. And then we limit portion. I'll limit them to like 2 fist-sized portions of berries every day. And then the rest of the benefits that they would get from fruit in terms of like fiber and mineral intake, they can get from vegetables. Get them eating way more leafy greens, deeply pigmented vegetables like peppers and carrots and that sort of thing. Then people will ask me, well, what about peppers and autoimmune conditions, blah, blah, blah. And that's a whole other kind of can of worms. So when I get asked a question like, are bananas good for me or not, it's really impossible to answer that question because no food is inherently good or bad, right? It's all about what else is going on for that person and their health goals.
More to come from Dr. Heather. Stay with us. So we just wanted to come back on some of the markers that you use, Dr.
Yeah,
Heather, when it comes to aging.
Right.
Yeah.
So that article mentioned that they were tracking markers, but then didn't say what the markers were. So some of the markers that I use in my practice in order to understand risk factors for aging or cellular damage are fasting glucose and fasting insulin. And again, normal ranges often just reflect the absence of disease. They don't reflect ideal range. So fasting glucose should be under 5 millimoles per liter or under 90 milligrams per deciliter. Insulin should be under 14. I measure HbA1c, it should be under 5. I measure cholesterol, and most significantly, of course, LDL, which is your bad cholesterol, should be under 100. And your HDL, which is your good cholesterol, should be up over 60. That's protective. I get people to measure homocysteine levels. Homocysteine is also a predictive tool with cardiovascular disease. It should be under 10. I measure vitamin D status. I measure DHEA, which is a hormone. It should be up over 200 in men and women. And in men, I'll measure testosterone. It should be up over 550 picograms per ml. Body fat percentage, I always measure. If you keep women under 28% body fat and men around 20 or under 20, that's ideal. Some of the other tests that are useful or calcium scoring. We can actually measure calcium deposition in the blood vessels of the heart. We can measure circulating tumor cells, which is an indicator of cancer risk. We can measure oxidative stress in cells. We can measure nutrient status. Those are all things that are measurable that help us understand the cellular damage that goes with age-related changes.
A couple of people, actually the same person, I apologise, has come in asking about calcium and how they're saying they're high in calcium. How can I lower this?
Right. So great question. Here's someone who's actually got too much calcium in their blood. And of course, that's a risk factor for calcification in blood vessels. So the first thing to rule out is kidney disease. That's one of the things that can cause your calcium levels to go up. If kidney function is fine, then it's likely to be either just dehydration. They need to drink more water, and that's why their blood levels of calcium look high. Or it's that they're not getting enough other minerals. Their potassium levels might be low, their magnesium levels might be low. And again, if they're measuring magnesium, it has to be intracellular magnesium, red cell magnesium, not just serum magnesium. So if all of the other sort of organ markers for this person were fine, I would just put them, get them drinking enough water and put them on a bit of magnesium.
Now, Heather, you were saying to me before the show that you've seen a rise in people coming to see you with symptoms of anxiety and depression. Maybe it's, you know, mood swings, or maybe after the holidays, feeling a bit blue. So what would you do as a naturopath? How do you approach depression and anxiety with your patients?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, I mean, the common sense lifestyle factors we're all kind of aware of, you know, balancing our stress levels, having hobbies outside of work that keep our brain engaged in a different way, having good relationships, having strong relationships outside of our family relationships, so strong friendships, being able to take breaks from work, protecting our sleep cycle. Those are all things that are really important, and not just because they make us feel better, but because they actually help with brain chemistry regulation. So when we're talking about depression and anxiety, From a practical perspective, I'm interested in the lifestyle factors. From a clinical perspective, I'm interested in that biochemistry, brain biochemistry. And what we know about stress is that when our cortisol levels go up and our adrenaline levels go up, that depletes serotonin. And serotonin is sort of our happy, feel good, everything's okay neurotransmitter. It depletes dopamine, and dopamine is what helps us stay focused on tasks. So we start losing our short-term memory, we start becoming forgetful, and those are the things that often people will complain to me about in practice, and then we start talking about neurotransmitter regulation. I do sometimes see people who actually have clinical depression, and they have a history of trying different antidepressant medications. Most of the commonly prescribed ones work on serotonin levels, but only by preventing the breakdown of serotonin. They don't actually help us produce more serotonin on our own. So when in practice, when we start focusing on ways to improve our own serotonin production, then that's what helps us manage the depression without needing the medication, or that's what helps us wean people off medication if they're trying to get off of it.
We're going to be going into more detail tomorrow with Dr. Raymond Hamden. We're going to be talking about the links between depression and chronic disease, and maybe if you're diagnosed and how that affects your mental health. I was looking at an article here from the UK's Telegraph newspaper. Are we thinking about depression all wrong? And 1 in 10 of us will experience depression at some point. For decades, we've been told that serotonin is the key culprit for mood disorders. But now a growing number of doctors have a radical new theory of depression, that they're saying that in fact the result of inflammation in the body caused by the body's immune system reacting to an infection or stress could be links there. And as we've been talking about inflammation earlier on, it is interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting. And that those studies about inflammation and depression, I think it was interleukin 2 or interleukin 6 that they were studying, also segued into clinical data about using omega-3 fats in our diet as a treatment tool for depression. And they've done a bunch of clinical trials on omega-3 supplements in depression. And that also segues into the literature around treating depression with exercise, because exercise is such an important tool for inflammation regulation. And interestingly, the clinical trials showing positive outcomes in treating depression with exercise are actually much more compelling than many of the studies that look at drug-based therapies for depression. And yet it's so infrequent for people to hear their doctors advise them about exercise in the treatment of depression.
Isn't it interesting? And you think about the rise in, okay, there's more awareness across the board in health, wellness, you know, mental health, physical health. But if you think about that, mental health is on the rise, illness is on the rise,
right,
across ages. I think one of the studies I was looking at was saying, you know, when it says 1 in 10, but also the average age, 14 years of age. Depression can start to show sign. You can start to show signs of depression at 14 years mm-hmm. of age. So if that's on the rise, and then you think about how we're exercising less, we're more sedentary, we're more stressed, we're more busy, generally speaking, of course, then you start to see some correlation here, possibly.
For sure. Yeah, of course.
And, you know, and not being in nature as much as we should be.
Yeah, that's a whole other topic. Yes.
For another time, Dr. Heather. Dr. Heather Ead, it's been an absolute pleasure broadcasting with you over the years. And yeah, it's our last show together. together. But you know what? It will continue with Dubai Today and Eye on Health. So a big thank you to Dr. Heather Ead, naturopathic physician at Novamed Integrative Medicine, based in Sunset Mall. We've posted up Dr. Heather's details up on our blog post today, so you can connect with her there at DubaiEye1038.com. Until the next time, Dr. Heather.
Thank you, Susanna. It's been a real pleasure.
And I look forward to having that little party with you.
Absolutely. So.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.